Break your fingers!
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the city's most active promoters, musicians, and by the driving force of the music scene, the fans. Liveband.com's listings are different because they are integrated with profiles updated by bands and business owners as they promote upcoming events. Check out the archives to see how closely we've worked within the community to put on the shows you love. Visit livemusicvancouver.com for the latest independent and major label event listings. Liveband.com, Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar.
Hey, this is Noah from Christ on Parade, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Where's that?
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, it's the goodbye to the Queen of Woo edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, circumcision, Oprah Winfrey, the police state, an interview with Mr. Deity. Now let's begin episode 117.
Welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your born-again hockey fan. For those people who don't know, it was announced today in the news that Winnipeg has got back its NHL franchise. For those people who don't know as well, I am originally from Manitoba, so this is somewhat good news for me. Ethan, I understand you're a bit of a hockey buff yourself.
Yeah, a bit, yeah, just a tad. Long overdue, I think.
It is.
Very sad to see these half-empty arenas, more than half-empty, virtually empty arenas in the United States. Why not put a team in Canada where people will appreciate them?
Well, you know, and it's interesting too, right? I feel sorry for Atlanta. This is the second team they've lost.
Yeah.
Both times to Canadian cities.
Woo-hoo. That's right.
First one the Calgary Flames got, and Winnipeg Jets come to Winnipeg. But I really love the new technique the Winnipeg has stumbled across to help guarantee that it has a full stadium. Do you know what that new technique is?
What is it, John?
It's got like the smallest stadium in the NHL. So apparently it's like 1,000-plus seats smaller than the next smallest stadium out there,
yeah.
Which you think is crazy. But I bet you when you look at it and you see all the seats are full, you're going to say they were pretty smart.
Well, I bet you they'll try to expand that stadium as well. And who knows, if it turns out to be really popular, maybe they'll just build a whole new stadium for
it. Wow. Yeah. At taxpayer expense. But speaking of things coming and going.
Yes, coming and going. Oprah Winfrey has retired, and Science Everywhere, breathes a sigh of release.
Well, some science. We should be fair. Oprah is kind of like a form of Bill Maher, right? She's been a good defender of climate change. She was out there about health standards for meat, which I think you're mentioning. Mm-hmm. But she was also the queen of...
of woo. Well, so on May 25th, the world was forever changed when Oprah Winfrey finally retired after doing her show for 25 years. Did you ever watch her show?
Not knowingly. I mean, it has been on when I was channel surfing because she's been on for like forever. So yeah, it'd be kind of hard not to have seen her.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, many will remember her for her humanitarian work and her book club and her positive attitude. But I think us as skeptics will remember her more as the Queen of Woo and, well, some of the dubious things that she's promoted over the years. Now, Oprah has a media empire, and I don't think anyone has ever seen anything like this ever.
With the possible exception of Martha Stewart, but let's be fair, at least Oprah has kept her ass out of prison where Martha Stewart hasn't.
Right. Well, I think Oprah's empire exceeds Martha's reach by quite a bit as well. See, the problem with having such a huge empire of media is that Oprah's opinions get sent out to everywhere, and her voice takes on far more power than you or me or anyone else, really.
Which just goes with the classic saying, with great power comes great responsibility.
That's right. And in one case, because Oprah expressed her, her sort of disgust with the mad cow scare and the meat industry.
She just said that she was worried to eat meat because of mad cow disease.
She got sued by meat industry proponents, and it became this big court case of sort of a battle of free speech. Or, for example, does Oprah, as a media mogul, have a responsibility to make sure her opinions are evidence-checked?
Okay.
And perhaps skeptics would make that same argument. But one of the areas where Oprah's reach has been felt negatively is in the realm of science. And over her career, she's promoted dozens of dubious health treatments and bogus scientific theories. Now, the most obvious example, of course, is the anti-vax movement. Oprah has brought on the spokesperson for this campaign, Jenny McCarthy, many times to promote her disproven allegations that vaccines cause autism and are dangerous. You know, Oprah's unique position as a household name and marketing force gave the anti-vax movement more momentum than it ever should have had. According to a Jenny McCarthy body count website, which is a site that keeps a tally of all the deaths that result from vaccine-preventable illnesses that have occurred since McCarthy began her crusade against vaccines in the U.S., that number is currently at 727, and the number of preventable illnesses is set at 79,365. Now, I would imagine those numbers would be down quite a bit if Oprah hadn't given McCarthy a spotlight to promote her anti-science.
Yep.
You know, Oprah's demographic is mostly women, and most of them are mothers. They're, you know, daytime moms watching TV, right? So Oprah would market a lot of pseudoscience towards these mothers. And Jenny McCarthy is a good example of this, because Jenny would often say things like, "My mommy instinct is more useful than a doctor's advice any day of the week." And this is a very silly argument to make. I don't think Jenny McCarthy has any experience diagnosing medical conditions whatsoever.
Well, I also can't help but feel that that's somehow, I don't know, patronizing or demeaning. It's like something to say, oh, it's just women's instinct. And like, as you know, and I don't know, it just seems negative on the outset. Have there ever been any research studies into the mommy instinct?
Well, the mommy instinct is, as you say, intuition. And I don't think there's been any study anywhere that would indicate that intuition has any basis in scientific theories. In fact, when we chatted with Rebecca Watson, look up the interview, folks, she described women's intuition as sort of the equivalent of male logic. You know, like men have math and science and evidence, and women have, you know, magic and women's intuition and, you know, the secret.
Sorry, you're coming across as a bit condescending, that women somehow are illogical, irrational, men are rational, logic. How did she kind of mean that?
Well, because, you see, Oprah is sort of marketing this sort of mythical version of women. This notion that a woman relies on her sense of intuition to navigate the world, when that's just sexism. Women, like men, are great at math and science and reasoning and critical thinking, and we all use these skills. I mean, you don't drive blindfolded and rely on your intuition to get you someplace.
I mean, there isn't such a thing as men math and women math. It's all just math.
It's all just math.
Wow.
It's not gendered at all, which is great. You know, Oprah sort of promotes this kind of, I guess you could call it spiritualism. And I guess spiritualism by itself isn't harmful, but Oprah doesn't seem to have any kind of filter of what spiritualism she promotes. So she would frequently have on her show people like Deepak Chopra or John of God, who is this con man faith healer who uses sleight of hand tricks to make people think that he's doing some kind of like magical psychic healing on them. And these tricks were debunked by James Randi on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, you know, a decade or so ago. It's quite commonly known how, you know, you take a chicken entrail in your palm of your hand and pull it out of someone's stomach.
Well, you know, and I think it does a great disservice, too, to women and all that. Because, I mean, one of the things I think you're kind of hinting on, you know, the idea of spiritualism, which is not innately bad, is that, I mean, women do have a slightly different way of looking at the world. Because we do have a bifurcated cultural society, right? Although we have the same sort of equipment to come up with logical, because culture has put us into different roles. I mean, women do have a different way of looking at things. There is, the culture of caring, which is an ethics school in logic and that, where, well, I'm sorry, in ethics. So, I mean, you know, there is a lot of things she could have brought to the table that would have sort of promoted this, you know, female feminist sort of look on the world. But instead of promoting that as much as she has, she somehow got deceived. I mean, do you think it's willful deceit, or
it's really hard to say with this. I mean, I'm sort of leaning towards the assumption that Oprah thinks she knows what's best for people. And if Deepak Chopra and John of God make even one person more spiritual, which is clearly what Oprah wants in the world. I mean, if you look at a lot of what she's been saying on her show, not just relating to science, but just in terms of life in general, she wants people to be more spiritual and more in tune with their emotions and that. And sure, being attuned to your emotions is great. It's a wonderful thing. But when you're promoting somebody who will take thousands of dollars for you and, you know, starve you half to death on some retreat in India or perform psychic surgery on you in Brazil, that's just being irresponsible. And it's hard to say what Oprah really thinks. I can't get inside her head. I don't really want to get inside her head. But, you know, it's
can't
dubious.
John of God do that for you?
Well, I don't want him inside my head either, that's for sure. One area that Oprah's legacy is going to be felt is in the people who she's given talk shows and given a platform to speak. So, for example, there's Dr. Phil McGraw, who is apparently a psychologist, although my big question is, what is he a psychologist of?
Actually, someone asked me this the other day, and he is a clinical psychologist. He's got his PhD from Texas University. Mm-hmm. Before Oprah found him, though, he was actually a court psychologist who was intended to do sort of crime scene investigation sort of stuff, not CSI, but more of a psychology version of that. So he has some credentials, but I think this is where Oprah tends to go off the thing. Because he's a doctor, therefore everything he says must be valid and true. Mm-hmm. So when he sits there and he does his little hokum thing saying, well, you're addicted to crack. Well, you just gotta solve it yourself because you're the fault of your own problems. And if he's got all this hokum as his advice.
Yeah.
And
I sort of characterize it as he does a kind of pop psychology with sort of down-to-earth psychobabble with a charming Texas accent, you know, and that's really not where you want to go when you have a deep problem, right? The other thing that kind of irks me about Dr. Phil is that he's actually been brought before his board on various charges of not like malpractice, but having improper relations with patients. And I don't mean not like sexual relations. I mean like things like going into business with them and stuff like that. He's also been promoting things like weight loss medication, which he's not qualified to do. He's not a physician.
Oh.
So dubious there. But I think the worst of all, the absolute cream to the crop of bad science is Dr. Oz. This is the person that Oprah would bring on the show to talk about science-based medicine, or so we would think.
Right.
When we first came on, it was sort of like, okay, there's a doctor. He's kind of a little strange, but he does talk about science, right? But eventually Oprah gave this Dr. Oz, this Dr. Mehmet Oz, his own TV show. And he's pretty much promoted every dubious alternative medical treatment you can think of. He's done shows on homeopathy. The worst, most egregious thing he did was he brought on John Edwards, a self-proclaimed psychic, for a segment called Are Psychics the New Therapists? And gave this charlatan a national stage to promote his
crossing over
mentality.
Here I thought you were going to say, you know, are psychics the new therapist? No. But no, he didn't go that way. He thought, you know, hey, I'm in this for the money or some such thing. And he just gave the guy a stage to promote his own economic interests, both Oz's and...
I mean, listeners may have remembered Dr. Novella, Steve Novella, the host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, was actually on Dr. Oz's show. And he did a reasonably good job. I mean, when you go onto someone's show who has completely etiquette control of what the listener sees, right? But he came across pretty well, although Dr. Oz always got the last word in. And, you know, it was an interesting segment, but ultimately I think, you know, Oz has really crossed over to the dark side on this one. He really doesn't seem to understand why promoting someone like John Edwards is a really, really bad idea.
So let's do a little recap then, and Ethan, I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Sure.
I know you weren't prepared for this, but you said you had Dr. Novella and you had Dr. Oz. They're both doctors. Why should I believe Dr. Novella is a more credible source for information than Dr. Oz? What kind of criteria, if I was listening to one of these shows, what criteria do you think I should bring to it?
Well, you know, it's tough. You shouldn't just assume that because someone has a couple letters in front of their name, they're a trustworthy source. But, I mean, you want to measure whatever they say with some level of skepticism. So, you know, if Dr. Oz is up there talking about homeopathy and he's saying, you know, this little pill that's, you know, got the memory of water diluted over a sugar pill is going to cure cancer, you have to kind of measure that against what you already know about cancer. You have to measure whether or not that's in line with the consensus view of science. And I mean, this kind of goes back to the whole problem of you shouldn't get your medical advice from a daytime talk show in the first place.
Even if it was Novella's.
Even if it was Novella's, I would say this is not the right forum for dealing out health advice. You know, it's like the call-in, it's like the Fraser Crane show, right? You call into a psychiatrist on the radio, I don't know. You need to sit down with somebody and actually explain the situation to them.
And to be fair, anyone who's listened to the SGU, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, whenever they try and put a medical question to Dr. Novella, he says, you know, well, listen, you know, this is not really the forum to do it, and I might give you a flippant answer, but take note, this is just off the top of my head, and if you really do have a problem, go see a doctor who can get the complete story about what you really do need.
Yeah. The great thing about, you know, what Dr. Novella does is he doesn't try to give out medical advice. He uses his experience to weigh in on medical claims. So I'm sure they'll be talking about some new cancer treatment or something, and he'll say, well, you know, in my experience, here's what I've seen, here's what I think. But he doesn't say, as a doctor, I recommend you take such and such, right?
Well, and he also, when he does use his experience, it's also science-based. As in,
absolutely,
it's not anecdotal, it's not, this is the latest trend, there are studies, etc., behind it that have shown consistently, because even when they do kind of corner him on a new study, he says, well, I'm going to wait to see if this has been confirmed, or if there's, you know, some confounding factor to this.
Right. Well, let's go to a commercial break. We'll be back with more here on Radio Freethinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station.
Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on.
College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Don, we got an email from a listener.
We did. We received a letter from a loyal listener, thanks, Aaron, who was asking us whether circumcision was really a valid method of HIV infection prevention or just an attempt by, quote, Westerners to impose a religious tradition on a vulnerable population, i.e. in the context of Africa and the spread of AIDS. First things first, when we talk about this, we're referring to male circumcision and not female genital mutilation. There should be no confusion that the two are even remotely similar. So, that being said, the first question we should ask, so...
Does circumcision reduce HIV transmission?
Thank you. Yeah. So, does it? Well, the scientific evidence actually seems quite clear on this. Circumcision does reduce HIV transmission in the male population by over 60% and transmission to women by 50%. This is based upon a large number of peer-reviewed, independent, randomized studies. This is not done by one corporation who's intent on promoting a particular issue. Mm-hmm. So the science seems clear that circumcision does help prevent the spread of AIDS. Now, in your own research, and we always recommend listeners to do their own research, as much as trustworthy as we are, mm-hmm. always go for your own, you may find some studies that report to show circumcision in the North American context has no effect on HIV transmission, raising, of course, the question as to the true effectiveness of the procedure and perhaps a double standard between here and there. Now, these studies, from what I've been able to decipher, are actually volunteer surveys where men are asked in a volunteer setting whether they'd be willing to go into a study for circumcision on HIV transmission and would be willing to be circumcised themselves. This shows that the apparent impact on HIV transmission would actually be minimal based on these surveys, because apparently a low number of men are willing to participate or have the procedure done to them. However, this is not actually a study of the effectiveness of circumcision, but a cultural willingness of men to be circumcised as adults. Also, the target population was the gay community, where HIV transmission via anal intercourse has a very different morphology than vaginal intercourse. So, you know, when it comes to the actual effectiveness of HIV, it is still shown, even in this particular case, to have a reduction. So there's also a very strong correlation between circumcision and the prevention of penile cancer. Although the mechanism itself is less understood, the vast majority of cases of penile cancer occur in uncircumcised men. The odds of developing penile cancer are magnitudes less in circumcised men, and if you've been circumcised at birth, it is so small that it is statistically non-existent.
Right.
So we've answered sort of the first question. Circumcision does help reduce the spreads of AIDS. So, you know, the next question maybe we should ask is that, well, you know, as a good atheist, maybe we shouldn't promote a religious practice. I mean, circumcision is very much associated with the Judeo faith. And that, you know, maybe, you know, because it does have this overt association with Judaism and the West, that we are somehow unwillingly supporting or advocating a form of Western colonialism, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when I did some research into this, I guess my answer is no or yes, depending on how we should support the practice of circumcision, because really it's been a historical accident that the practice is associated with Judaism. It's also a Western attitude, because a vast majority of religiously circumcised men in the world are actually Muslim and not Jewish. And if you do a little more historical research into it, circumcision has a very, very long tradition. It's not actually exclusively associated with Judaism or even the Abrahamic religions. It was a practice in pharaonic Egypt, you know, when the pharaohs pre all that, right? Mm-hmm. It's a rite of passage still in parts of Western Africa. So that being said, you know, I don't feel comfortable when missions like this are somewhat overly stressed the religious nature of it. I heard of one particular case of a mission to Africa called Operation Abraham, where a team of, quote, practiced Israeli doctors were doing mass circumcision of men in Africa. That being said, I don't like it when churches have soup kitchens either, right? And there's an overt thing there. But until we're able to, you know, provide the resources to do this in a secular area, until we can pony up and do it ourselves without these religious things, I think in the essence of harm reduction, we hold our noses and say, you know, at least in the long run, it's doing good, and maybe we should be going in there and making sure there's not an overt message with it.
Right. I have noticed, though, that the science behind circumcision is not entirely cut and dry. I was looking at the notions, the numbers on penile cancer, and despite the fact that about 1 in 600 uncircumcised men in the U.S. will get penile cancer, the American Cancer Society doesn't consider circumcision a prevention strategy due to other factors like hygiene being more important. And this could also indicate why in like sub-Saharan Africa, circumcision is promoted, but in other more developed countries where, you know, safe sex and hygiene is more widely used, it's not really particularly necessary.
Well, actually, and you've stumbled across one of the other controversies that come into this. A number of people who tend to be in an ideological thing have an a priori sort of dislike for circumcision itself. They consider it to be a form of mutilation. Mm-hmm. So they tend to allow that to overcloud their issue. It's not intended to be circumcision only. It is supposed to be part of a package,
right,
of things to do that. And actually, that leads into another interesting area, is that, you know, some people have argued, you know, well, that if this is for AIDS production, AIDS prevention, right, HIV, how come low circumcised population in white countries, why aren't they promoting it there? And to understand this, right, I mean, first of all, we have to understand both the prevalence of circumcision and the prevalence of HIV infection. Now, the region in the world with the highest rate of circumcision is actually Saharan Africa, that's North and West Africa, and the Middle East, followed by North America. The regions with the lowest rate of circumcision are Europe, South America, and of course parts of sub-Saharan South Africa. Now, on this information alone, one again could jump to the conclusion and say, well, hey, you know, aren't you practicing a double standard? Why aren't you sending missions into Eastern or Western Europe and having them? Well, then you have to go contrast that, the cultural practice with the medical need. Now, if we look at the prevalence of HIV infections and the deaths from AIDS, we see that actually the highest rates are in sub-Saharan Africa, while Europe has some of the lowest. Now, I'm sure this discrepancy has a lot more to do with links between poverty and underdeveloped medical infrastructures, but nonetheless, it's there. Mm-hmm. And just to throw in my kick at the can, the fact that the Catholic Church is much more stronger promoting the disuse of condoms in Africa, whereas they don't seem to do it quite as much in more developed countries. But if you look at the prevalence of HIV in Eastern Europe, it's about 0.8%, South America 0.5%, Western Europe 0.2%. Contrast that with sub-Saharan Africa, which has 5%, where 1.2 million people have died in 2009, that's the stats I was looking at, died, where you get, I think, Western Europe had 8,000 who mm-hmm. died, right? So when you contrast the prevalence of circumcision and the need to reduce HIV transmission, it doesn't seem to be a form of cultural imperialism. And let's take one step back. Let's say, okay, it is cultural imperialism. Great. In the essence of harm reduction, I don't see why we wouldn't even promote it. I mean, for example, I'm going to go Godwin on you here, but let's give okay. give me the break. The Nazis believed in jet airplanes. Does that mean we should abandon jet airplanes because it's associated with the Nazis? Well, no. I mean, if it's a valid method that happens to be used by something that we think is despicable and we don't like, right, then it still should be promoted in spite of its association.
Yeah, I mean, if it works, then it's a useful tool. And we have to be able to divorce the ideas from the people who came up with the ideas, or even the people who just used the ideas in general, right? Like, you can say the same thing, you know, mustaches. Well, Hitler had a mustache. Ergo, mustaches are bad.
You know, and actually this falls into an interesting thing, because in an odd sort of way, it is very, very effective for Africa, where the Catholic Church, and I'm kicking on them again, has a big resurgence. They've got growing adherence to that, right? But they have this big thing about condoms. And condoms, so far from what I understand, is actually the most effective way to prevent HIV transmission. And the Catholic Church says, no condoms. But ironically enough, they have no prohibition against circumcision, provided it's not for religious reasons. But if you're just doing it for medical reasons, they say, snip away, no problem. So in an odd sort of way, it is not only effective, but it's almost tailor-made for this particular community that has these other cultural baggage to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah, and it is a kind of tricky question in that regard. Like, why would the Catholic Church be willing to promote one avenue of sort of healthy living versus, but not another avenue?
Well, we know why.
Well, we know why. But I mean,
every sperm is sacred.
Sure it is. Yeah, we should have the song queued up, but we don't.
So there is one last thing that we haven't touched on this, and I think we're pretty much at the end of this, and I don't want to go into this, but if you're interested to go into this, send us your feedback. The idea of circumcising children in North America, where we don't necessarily have the